Chuck Sickinga interviewing Miss Dorothy Dermo for the Tri-Cities Museum on September 18th, 1991.
And 1904, November 5th.
Okay. And have you lived in this area your whole life?
I've lived in this house most of my life.
This very house. Okay.
A few times I have been away for a couple of years or maybe a few more, but back again.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you have an earliest memory of this area that comes to mind right offhand?
Well, when I was very tiny, maybe I should have started that way. My dad built this house in about 1902. And then he and my mother were married in 1903. End of 1902, or the first of 1903. And I was born in 1904. And he worked at whatever he could get. He had done a lot of work all over the state, really. He was a surveyor some of the time. Some of the time he worked in Milwaukee for a commission agency. And he did some things like that around Grand Haven, too, when they raised a lot of small fruit, but then he gave that up and wasn't enough in it. When I was about 4 years old, he went to fishing clams on the river. The river was beautiful and deep. And fishing clams at that time was quite a productive business. He would fish. There were a number of men that fished. In fact, I would say 50, because when he took the clams to the factory in Lamont, which is up the river, they had a factory up there to cut buttons. And he was the foreman for over the 50 men. And they cut buttons out with little round, tiny round saws. Power saws, little tiny round saws. You've seen them when they use punch presses and things like that. Well, that's what they did with these little saws.
Oh, okay.
Saw the buttons out of shells. And they had to have special clams. They all had to be sorted very carefully so that the buttons would be perfect. And he did that 2 winters. Then about that time, these construction aggregates started doing some gravel hauling down the river, and they spoiled all the clam beds because they had to have the river dredged, and they dredged through the mud any place they wanted to. And the clam beds were more to the side of the river where the water wasn't quite so deep. And we couldn't fish all summer anyway, because when the weeds started growing, then they concealed the beds. And then they'd have to quit clamming, but they had gotten the best of them before that time. And then that was quite a process, too, because my father would come home with a boatload of clams. And I mean a boatload. He had a big old-fashioned boat, looked like a scow. And he had it full of clams. And they'd take them on shore, and they had a cooker they put them in. It looked like about an eight-foot tank. It was about a foot deep, and they put them in that, and then just about that much water in the bottom of it. They cook them a little bit, not much, just enough to make a little steam in them to make them open. Then they'd open, and then they'd pitch them up on a table, and they open the clams through the shells into a pile, sorted them as they went. And the meats, my dad always kept those, and then he would dry them as soon as he got a chance, the same day, but later in the day. And they always went through, my mother did, they always went through the meats very carefully, looking for pearls. And they found quite a few. They sold a lot of pearls. And then they had a lot of stuff they found that were called slugs. About 1910. It's what they weighed.
Oh, yeah,
they weighed the slugs with that. Mm-hmm. He used to go to the jewelry stores, and they would buy the slugs, and other people would come in that used them and buy them from them. They used that a lot years ago. My dad was pretty proud of that. Then he gave up doing that because my mother didn't want him to be away. And he started doing raising small fruit. Well, all the farmers around the country did things like that to make a living. It wasn't easy to make a living around this part of the country at that time. And, oh gosh, excuse me. I forgot one of the main things I should have told you in the beginning. What do you do about that?
Just go right ahead and put it in now.
My dad was born in 1880. 1888, he moved down here on the riverbank with his family. And at that time, my grandmother took in all the loggers that came down the river with logs. When they get down in this area, they'd have to put them up for the night. They'd have to pin them to the shore somewhere along. You probably never saw them, but they used to have pens they put them in. They had the piling in the water, and it would run out, kind of like make a V from the bank of the river. And they'd run the logs in those Vs to keep them from getting away. Because the closer they got to the lake, the faster they would go.
Right.
And they were bringing them down to Grand Haven and to Spring Lake, because there were lumber mills all around the banks in Grand Haven and Spring Lake, mostly in Spring Lake. Because when I was very small, my dad would take me down the river sometimes with him and show me, he'd point with an oar like this and show me the edgings that were under the edge of the water. When they were getting rid of all that stuff from the lumber mills, they'd put it out along the bank, like they're trying to make a dock, get rid of all that stuff. My dad worked in some of the factories later on. He tried the tannery and tried a couple of other factories, but he was not an inside man. He had pneumonia a couple of times, and he was not in good inside. He was breathing inside the factories. Some of the time, people came from Chicago, and a lot of them went up here on Pottawatomie and on Millhouse Bayou. There were resorts, and people would go up there. They come over on the boats from Chicago, the big ones. There used to be big boats come in here. And my dad still had his big launch. It was kind of like a big Chris craft. It had an inboard motor and a long seat around on each side. And he'd go down to the dock and pick them up early in the morning when they came in, when the boat came in. And then he'd deliver them up here because they had no transportation from down there out here. Because those resorts didn't have horses or anything. Some of them had maybe an old car, but everything was delivered. They'd buy stuff in the stores, but the storekeeper would deliver stuff to them.
What years are we talking? Are we talking mid, like 1915?
Yeah, 15. I was about, let's see, I was born in 1904. 13, 14.
Okay.
I was pretty small yet. Then in the summertime, too, people wanted to go over on Rosie Mound. That was quite a place at that time. It's lost its beauty by far. It isn't pretty anymore. But at that time, they had huge beechnut trees all over. Beautiful big trees. You never saw anything so pretty in your life. And they were usually all loaded with beechnuts. People would go up there to get beechnuts in the toward fall. And they had paths up the side of the mountain, and people would go up to the top of the mountain and go over to the lake. It was a summertime. Every year they had to go up there 2-3 times when they were here. usually we went with them. Some of the people had horses that they brought over with them on the boat, and some of them didn't. Some of them bring a couple of buggies over. Some of them didn't. Some of them bring riding horses over. And then they could bring their horses out, but the rest of the family would have to come with my dad. The fishermen were always fishing in the lake. The fishing nets, that was quite a business in those days, fishermen on Lake Michigan. Mm-hmm. After he was through clamming and had a little bit of time, he went out to Highland Park. Somebody called him to come out there. And he had quite a few pearls left. And they asked him to show the pearls to some women from St. Louis.
Well.
And some of them had a string of pearls that had been broken, and they wanted to match them so they could replace them. Well, one woman asked him to... She could see him, and he showed him to her. And she brought out her pearls, and they found one that looked pretty much like hers. My dad said, "Well, I wouldn't match it. I wouldn't sell it to you." And she said, "Well, why not?" She says, "These are good pearls." He says, "They are not. He says, they're imitation." Oh, she got mad. And he said, "Well..." He says, "You don't have to believe me if you don't want to, but," he said, "I'll prove it to you if you want me to." He said, "Will you let me cut one of them in two?" "Well, you can't do that." She says, "You couldn't do that." He says, "I can do it very easily." So she handed him the pearls, and he cut one in two. He always carried a very sharp pocket knife. And he laid it on the velvet pad that he showed him on. And he cut it in two just as easy as that. Oh, was she furious? She had paid a terrific price for those, and they were imitations. They sold a lot of pearls out there, though. People wanted them for gifts and replace for rings and things like that. There's a lot of poor land around here at this part, and for quite a few years it was very noticeable that it was poor down around West Olive, Agnew, and up toward Grand Haven, and this way. You couldn't raise a self-respecting sandbar, it was so poor. It was terrible, and so many of the farmers that came from Chicago, and they couldn't make a living. Their families, no way. Well, some of them had to go to the factories, in which they did, but it was a bad start for them. And then a real good man from the agricultural office had been east, and he came back with some good ideas about planting Christmas trees, planting pines all over, and planting blueberries. And he brought some blueberry plants back with him, and that's how they got started.
Really?
At the end of the Depression. But the Depression had hit so hard that everybody was scared to make one move.
Uh-huh. So blueberries have only been here for the last 60 years?
Yeah, 50
years?
Not even hardly that long. Because it took quite a while for them to get started. Because only all they had were a few plants. And they had to send east to get some more, and then they had to take cuttings and grow them from scratch. But it worked out good. But he tried. This man's name was Mr. Arnold. He was real good.
Yeah. I never knew that before.
Yeah. Some of the other fellows have always come claim the honor of being a the beginner, but they were not. They were not. Some of them took it up, you know, and pushed it. But Mr. Arnold's the one that brought the things in the beginning.
Now, as you were growing up in this area as a child, what sort of things did you do personally for recreation?
Well, I didn't have much recreation because I worked with my dad most of the time. I had no brothers and no sisters, and we lived at the end of the line. There were no houses anywhere around here close by. There were two or three, but they had no children. And then if I went farther, they had children, but then it was too far away. Well, then a friend of my father's had a milk route in Grand Haven, and he called my dad to come down one day or sent word to him to come in. So my dad said he was going to go in the afternoon. He wanted me to go with him, so I went. And the man's name was Mr. Locke, Chris Locke, and he had loaned a man some money. The money man hadn't been able to pay him, and he was a fellow who had a racehorse, and the racehorse had been disqualified for the track anymore because of its age. When they were 6 years old, they wouldn't take them anymore for racing, and so he took the horse. They got the horse to his house somehow. I don't know who, somebody brought it to his house. He lived out on I think Ferry Street. I'm pretty sure it was Ferry Street. It's all grown up, so now I can't hardly tell you where it was. But Warbers and Locks lived out that way. Warbers had a dairy, and Mr. Locke had a dairy. And Locks had a real nice place. He always had kept his place up really well. So he had a barn and a stable with for horses and for cows. He had several buildings. And then he had like a paddock for the horses to be in. And he couldn't catch that horse no matter what. So that's what he wanted my dad to do, is catch that horse that afternoon. My dad says, well, I'll catch her. So he went up and caught the horse. And Mr. Locke wanted him to take it home with him. And Dad says, I don't want the horse. I have no use for it. He says, I have a milk route. He says, I've got to have a slow horse. Well, that I can stop wherever I want to stop. He had an old horse they called Billy, and that horse had been on a mail route, and he stopped at every mailbox. So my dad got him trained to, that wasn't the place he was to go. After he found out where all the customers were, that's where he went. They learn in a hurry. And my dad came back home. Well, then a couple of weeks later, Mr. Locke called him again. He says, you got to take that horse. He says, I'll practically give it to you to get rid of it. He says, it's driving me crazy. My dad says, well, I don't want it, but I'll take it home. I'll see what I can do with it. So he took the horse home. Well, I wasn't in high school yet then. I was probably in 7th or 8th grade, maybe. My dad put the horse in the barn. He says, now you stay away from that horse because it'll kick you or it'll bite you. Well, that's all I needed to hear. The horse would either kick me or bite me. So I went out and I picked clover about every day or some other thing that I knew the horse would like, you know. And I'd go in and I'd feed the horse through the slats in the barn. And I made friends with the horse. And one day I was sitting on a horse's back when my dad came home, and he nearly had a fit. Then the next time he came home, I had the horse out tied to a tree right by the barn door. Well, he almost did fly. That ended that. I was riding the horse before he came home again. And, you know, I could go any place in the woods, no matter where I went. That horse would stop me where I wanted it to and stand right still. And if I were down picking flowers or something like that, then the horse had his nose right over my shoulder all the time. It wouldn't leave me. And I had that horse for quite a long time.
So, at that time, I'd imagine this area was all still completely undeveloped?
Yeah. No houses around here at all. Then they begin to put some houses along that riverbank over here. There were a few over there, maybe half a dozen. Let's see now. I'm trying to think of the name of the... Who used to own Michigan Brass? Do you know?
No.
No, not Michigan Brass. Grandhaven Brass. You don't know?
No.
I can't think of the name. Anyway, the fellow was a brother, had a brother that lived in Buffalo, and they came up here. And they went up here to this cottage that was on the river in the summertime. And that was right around the 1930. And then we had more resorters that came on the bayou. More cottages built all the time. So that it was quite active around there.
Okay, now, when you were living here as a child, did you go into town often?
Well, when I went to high school, I went in all the time. But the only time I was in town very much was when my dad had the flu one year, and I was in the eighth grade then, I think. But I had gone with him a few times, so I had to go on the milk route, but I had to have somebody drive the horse for me because I couldn't do that and deliver the milk to him. So there was an old man lived over the hill over here, Mrs. Daniel's father, and I don't know what his name was anymore, but anyway, he drove the horse and I delivered the milk. But I had to stay home from school to do it, which didn't sit very good with the teacher.
Imagine that.
No. But you do things like that when you live in the country.
Right. When did you start school and where?
Well, I don't know what the year was. I was about 5 years old when I started. Going on 6 because my birthday's in November. That was when I was in school. I started then. When I was 6 is when we went to Lamont for the winter, because that's when my dad was in the button factory up there, and that's when he had pneumonia so bad. Even though he was the boss, he had pneumonia, and they had to get along without him. They had an awful time doing it, because there were none of the men that could sharpen those saws right. And I had pneumonia for almost all winter. And the only doctor we could get was an old doctor in Coopersville. And he had to come with a horse and buggy, and then with a horse and cutter, when it snowed. Then the next winter, we were back there again with the same family. We stayed all winter with the same family, both winters. And the next winter, I had pneumonia again. I couldn't be out in the cold so much. But I guess I've kind of licked at some, because I have been out in all kinds of weather since we had the dairy. It's not been funny, though. You do whatever you have to do.
Now, when you were going to school, like elementary ages, was there still school out at Peach? Was the Peach Plains still at the same location?
Mm-hmm.
And what sort of things did you study there? School-like?
We had history, arithmetic, English, grammar, spelling. Penmanship.
And did they give you homework back then?
No, I don't think I ever brought homework home. don't think I ever did. I can't remember that I did. Maybe I can't remember. When I was in high school, yes. Then I know I did, but I can't remember. In grammar school.
In grammar school, what was the day, or what was expected of students, I guess? How were they supposed to behave in class in those days?
Well, you just had to be quiet when, I'll tell you, that was a one-room school, and they had, one year we had 121 students in that one room.
Wow.
That's right, we did. And some sides of the school had bigger desks in, and then two big boys would be sitting at a desk. Then they'd go kind of downgrade. And so when they got a little smaller, there were three at a desk. 121. And one teacher. And she taught all those kids. And she did a good job.
How would she handle dealing with 121 kids, all of which were probably on different levels, in different grades?
Well, she'd probably have 8 or 10 in one grade. She kept them busy.
Would she, like, just give an assignment for everybody and have them be working on it and
yeah.
then go around and
they
check on everybody?
At their desks.
Okay, then when you got into junior high and high school, and you had to go into town, how would you get there every day?
Well, for a while I rode a bicycle, but that was too much for me. And then I stayed in town for a little while. And then we had a fellow, my dad had a fellow here that was working for us, and he had an old Ford coupe. And he told me one day, he said, "Say, you drive that to school after this. Instead of going with your dad." He says, "I don't need it, I don't use it." So I drove that for a while, about a year and a half. That was one way of getting to school. And then I went with a friend of mine from up on Stearns Bio. I went with her for almost 2 years. So then I got through high school that way.
What sort of things did you do for recreation as you got into high school? Were you still working pretty much all the time?
I didn't have anything in high school for recreation. Not anything. And anyway, I didn't have any time for recreation because I had to go home when I got out of school, because if I didn't, I'd have no way of getting home, see?
Mm-hmm.
So I had to go right home. Some of the other kids, I guess, had all kinds of recreation from what I heard, but it didn't help me any.
Okay. Now, what sort of, other than like delivering milk, what sort of things did you do for the dairy business?
Well, at the same time, I had to help my dad, and I wasn't getting anything out of it. So I raised chickens and had chickens and eggs I sold in Muskegon. I had quite a route up there once a week. I did all right on that.
How would you get there? Would you have to do?
Then I had a car.
Oh, okay.
Then I was a little older and I had a car. From then on, I did different things, you know, all the way along. I raised turkeys 2 years. I had 800 turkeys 2 different years. Made good money on them. Then, at that time, you could raise them any size you could get them to. Now, if you raise them, you've got to have them so many pounds, you know, 8 pounds, 10 pounds, 12 pounds. But at that time, you could raise them any size that you could get them to. We had about 5 that were over 50 pounds.
Whoa.
Yeah, big ones. Boy, when they walked around the yard, you knew you had a big bird out there. But we had them all sizes. An awful lot of them like that were past 30 pounds and up to 40 pounds. And I sold most all of them in Muskegon I sold an awful lot of them to a butcher that took them to some hotels and places like that where they used them all. And I made good money on them, too. That's how I paid the taxes and paid a lot of things for my dad.
Yeah, I guess this is backtracking a little bit, but how did the dairy business work, and what sort of things did you make? How did you go about making them as far as products?
Oh. My dad did pretty well in the beginning, but then after a while it didn't go so good. When they hit the Depression, it didn't go worth a darn. Too many people were out of work. And when he would drive in by the factories, he was delivering milk to some of the factories. They wanted him to bring milk to the factories for the workers. So he was doing some of that, too. Well, then I began to catch on what was going on because several people told me that they were stealing milk out of the truck. So I thought, well, I'm going to put a stop to that. So I had been reading a dairy journal. I don't know where I got it, but I was reading that. And they had the vending machines for milk and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So my dad had started to make chocolate milk. And he bought chocolate, the real good kind, Johnson's chocolate, that came from Milwaukee. Boy, everybody was crazy about that. He almost had to fight them off to get them out of the milk house out here.
Mm-hmm.
And, so we bottled a lot of that, and I bought 9 vending machines, I think it was. I wrote to a place in New York and asked them about vending machines and if I could get so many and when I could get them, what I wanted to do with them. And gee whiz, it was no time at all, and a big truck comes back, and in here they had the vending machines on the truck. And I hadn't even sent a dime to get them. Well, then they unloaded them out. We had this garage out here, and they unloaded them in the garage. And then we had to take them where we wanted them. And we had the, we bought grape concentrate and orange concentrate and Grand Rapids. And then the chocolate milk we made ourselves, and that's what we put in those machines. So much a bottle. The machines were about as big as that top of that table, maybe not quite. And the glass that was in the top of it, one piece on the end, about that much, was solid all the way across. Then the other parts had slits in them. And there was a handle, a long handle that went down in the slits, and about something about that big around that had rubber flippers in it. And you slide that around, you put your money in the machine, and you slide that through one of those slits and go wherever you want it to. When chocolate milk, you run down that slit and put the thing down on that chocolate bottle. Pick it up and bring it back to where it would release it when you got ready to come out with it.
Hmm.
That helped us a lot. Those machines worked good.
Yeah.
We didn't lose any more milk. Letting them get it for nothing. Then when my dad died, I sold the machines. I didn't want to, but I had figured on making ice cream too. We had a big ice cream machine stored in the garage. We bought it in the spring. And my dad died in the fall, but he got sick. And he had cancer. And so he died in January. And I couldn't handle the whole thing by myself.
Mm-hmm.
It was too much work. So they took the chocolate machine back. The ice cream machine back. We hadn't touched it, we hadn't opened it or anything. We just stored it in one stall in the garage.
Okay. through milk, did you have to pasteurize it yourself? And how did you do that?
We had a pasteurizer in the garage. Or in the milk house. Or that's the milk house down there that's up close to the road.
Okay.
And then we had the big glass window at the left-hand side of that door, the entrance door. And then we had the cooler was in front of the window, and the pasteurizer was just back of the cooler, so that it ran from the cooler over to the pasteurizer, so that the milk went into the pasteurizer, and you could start that up. And then we had a boiler was in another room, back farther. And the bottler was in right next to the pasteurizer.
You had a pretty complicated setup.
We couldn't do any better than we did. And my dad was not good at collecting bills. And I can understand that. I was going to try and do it too. But I swear, I lost my temper too. You know, you'd stop and you'd go to a house. I'd go to a back door or a side door. Once in a while, the front door, but not very often, because you know they're all in the kitchen, you know. I'd walk up to the door and I'd knock on the door and I'd hear people in the house. I knew there were people in the house. And I'd knock on the door. Nobody'd come to the door. And they'd be making an awful noise before you got there, but when I knock on the door, nobody would come to the door, and you could hear a pin drop. They were that quiet. So I got pretty provoked and pretty mad about it. I swear I'm done. I wouldn't go out and collect another bill. People, I think half the kids in Grand Haven grew up on Darrow's milk for free. Sometimes you can get pretty provoked with people that won't pay their bills.
I can imagine so. Did you have any recourse you could take with that? Any?
Mm-mm. Milk is gone. You lose more trying to collect it than you would if you let it go. You just can't get it.
Now, how did the depression affect the business?
Well, that was what started me. That was why I bought those vending machines, because we weren't getting along at all. And we couldn't handle everything. And I knew my dad was going downhill, and I knew I had to do something to handle him. That was why I bought the vending machines. And then when he was at the worst, well, then I shut the thing up right then. And one of the other dairies wanted to buy the vending machines. They paid me more for them than I paid for them. They didn't know what I paid for them, see. But I got my money out of them.
What sorts of sacrifices did you have to make during the Depression?
Lots of them.
Any specific ones that you remember? Any specific hardships that you went through that stand out?
When you always had a hard time getting sugar, and we had to go down the other side of Holland to a little place to get sugar for the chocolate. And then we got it in 10-gallon cans, those big milk cans, you know. Mm-hmm. I'd have to go down there with one of the little pickup trucks and get 10 of those full of that chocolate. I mean that sugar. And it was, I don't know how they worked it, but they put it in the cans in a kind of a liquid state. It would, just like if you were pouring a gravy in a bowl, and it would go back and forth, you know, or chocolate or something like that, how it goes back and forth. That's the way it ran in the cans when I backed the truck up. And I get quite a few of them in the truck when I went down, because they used half a can, I think, a day or something like that. You couldn't get regular sugar.
Yeah. Like when World War II came along, did, like rationing affect the dairy business at all?
No. Not really, because we had help, because we got a couple of neighbor boys to work. Then they would have had to go on in the service if they didn't come work on a farm. So we got them. But you know, you never know who you're going to get or what you're going to get. You might hire somebody and you don't know what they're going to turn out to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's not easy.
But, I mean, as far as the rationing went, you were able to get as much sugar for chocolate milk as you needed in that?
Yeah, we got enough to get by. Yeah, we got enough to get by.
Yeah, I'm sure you were... That helped business. You were probably able to sell quite a bit more.
Yeah. And chocolate all came from Milwaukee in big, great big barrels. I think they call them hogsheads. Like big drums.
Okay, now having lived in this location right here for just about all your life, I'm sure you've seen it grow and develop. When did the changes start to occur and more houses start to come up out this way?
Well, all through the Depression, not much of anything happened. Before the Depression, we had a few houses come in, but not very many. Then after the Depression and the war was on, then things began to build up a little bit. And from that time on, it has continued to. And all of a sudden, in the last, 5-6 years, it's really been a boom. You wonder how it all got started. I know I was told, a number of years ago, I was told that one of my bosses went to a big convention in Chicago, and some speaker was there from, I don't know where, but anyway, he told the people that by the turn of the century, there would be solid housing all the way from Milwaukee around the lake up to Manistee, 20 miles back from the lake, all the way around. Well, I guess he hit the nail on the head. It looks like it's going to go.
Yeah, he was pretty close to it.
Yeah, he was pretty close to it already. And some of the houses they're building, you wonder why they're building such big houses and such expensive houses. And the kids will all be going out of the houses in a short time to their own homes. What are those people going to do? Two people rattling around in a house big enough for an army.
Yeah,
did you ever think of that?
I wondered about that myself. I know. People I've known have built big houses just as their kids were little old. Okay, so how long did you stay in the dairy business then?
My dad started in about 1916, before the war was on. I think. Yeah, he did, because when I had to deliver the milk and had that old man to drive the horse for me, the war was on then. Because at that time, a big flock of horses went past here about dusk one night. There were about 200 of them. In a herd. There were men on horseback that were kind of herding them down the road, and they were to go over on one of the boats to Chicago. And what they were going to do with them, I have no idea. But they must have come from Grand Rapids or someplace like that, because they were all sizes and colors. And that that time is about the time when my dad was drafted. He would have had to gone to the war, but one or two days before he was to leave, he had sold everything so that my mother wouldn't have to do any chores around here. So then he had to start all over again when it was over.
So then the dairy business lasted until when?
Well, I quit in 1947. Yeah, really 46, but it was 47 before I got things straightened out.
Okay, and then what did you do after that?
Well, I worked at different places in Van Halen for a while, and then I went to work at Shell Machinery for it. I worked there for 21 and a half years. In the 1950s, I started the Christmas tree business.
Okay.
So that's what I've been doing along in my spare time.
And how has that worked?
All right. I like it.
Was it a chop your own Christmas tree place?
Or do I what?
Was it a cut-your-own Christmas tree business?
No, we ship them out.
Ship them out?
No, we ship them out.
To wherever?
Only ship them to Kansas, Missouri, New York, Illinois, other places in Michigan, Indiana, Missouri. Oh, we got a lot of places to ship into.
So, it wasn't like a place where somebody from Grand Haven would come to get their Christmas.
To bring their children out to pick out a Christmas tree. They get a big kick out of that.
Where I used to when I was a kid.
Yeah,
it's
so.
A big deal.
That's
so,
right.
Have you noticed any difference through the years? Have you gotten less business since more people have gone to fake trees, or have you gotten more business?
Well, the fake trees have not spoiled things half as much as some of these big nurseries north of here, up around Cadillac, Traverse City. Anywhere up in the northern part of Michigan are shipping trees south on consignment. Well, that just ruins everything.
Yeah.
That just ruins everything. And then we had 3 years ago a drought. 2 years ago we had a drought. Then last year we had the recurrence from that was hit the trees and it was needle drop on the trees. So we couldn't sell some of them because they had needle drop.
Mm.
Then it takes a year for them to recover.
Mm-hmm. Now, how do you have to manage like your tree fields? Do you have like, how long does it take a new tree to grow until it's big enough to be a Christmas tree?
About 8 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have quite a few trees, quite a few. And I don't know how it's going to come out this year because we don't have many orders yet. Last year they dropped the price down because of the trees that were shipped from the north. They were shipping them out on consignment and some of them never got their money at all. And a lot of trees in the north have never been pruned. Then now they'll never be any good if they're not pruned. They won't be any good. They won't recover. Because then they grow wild. The branches get too wild and they can't bring them back.
Right.
So I don't know what'll happen. I don't know what'll happen to us either. I'm not very happy about it, but then what can you do?
Okay.
I guess just to sum things up then, how would you evaluate your life in this area if you had to sum up your life?
Well, if things went all right, I would be very happy. I like to travel. I've traveled quite a bit, and I would like to do some more traveling. If I didn't have the Christmas tree business, then I could go do some traveling. I've been to Norway and Canada and West Coast. I've been out the West Coast about 8 times. I like the West Coast very much.
Yeah.
I've been on Northwest Passage up to Alaska.
I had to get up there myself.
It's beautiful.
Except my grandparents have been there. That's what they tell me.
Very, very beautiful. We went up to Alaska on the Northwest Passage in a ship that was Queen of the Fleet. And that was supposed to have been a freight line. They had 10 ships. And this was the queen. She was the one that carried all the passengers with the good boat. And that was a real good boat, too. And a good ship, I should say. We liked that very, very much. We went up a lot of towns we could stop at. And some of the towns up there have a lot of Russian, what do I want to say? Well, you know, you think you were in Russia when you get there. That's all there is to that.
Yeah.
We were in a church that you'd swear was Russian all together. And the museums were almost completely Russian. Some Indian. More Russian than anything. And one place we went up into Canada from this ship. And we were 7 miles inland from the border, I can't think of what I want to say. What do you call the town between on the border that has all the rules and regulations to get in?
The border? I don't know. I know there's a word for it, but I'm not sure what it is. It's like customs that you have to go through.
Customs. The customs buildings were 7 miles inside the border, up halfway up the line. And we had to go all the way into there from the ship. We went in by bus, came back by train to the boat. Mm-hmm. There we saw some awful things happen, because we went in by bus and we were high up, and even though we went back out of that area, we were high up on the side of the mountain, down in a valley. When we started down back again, there was a train down there, and the cars looked like about so big. The bridge had broken down years ago. They never could get any of that out of there.
Oh. Jeez. So.
My friend said to me when we were there, she said, "You want to look down there?" I said, "No, I don't want to look." Well, she says, "You better look because you won't see it again." So I looked and oh my stars. She said, that was what it was. You could see very plainly what it was, but they looked so tiny. They looked like these little trains that the kids get out of Cracker Jack or something like that. That's what they looked like.
It's amazing.
That far down. And the bridge that we were on, that we crossed on, coming around the mountain, we had about that much space on each side when we were on the bus. We couldn't meet anybody.
Okay. I think that'll...